this is The Hindu on Books, a weekly podcast from India's national newspaper on the latest and the best from the world of literature.
Hello everyone, welcome to The Hindu's Books Podcast. And I'm KC Vijayakumar, sports editor of The Hindu. In the latest episode of The Hindu's Books Podcast, I'll be in conversation with author Neha Sinha. Her latest book, Wild and Willful, is a wonderful treatise on wildlife literature. In fact, it can be considered as one of the finest expositions of wildlife literature. Neha lucidly chronicles diverse species ranging from the elephant to tiger butterflies, draws wonderful pen portraits of these species, and makes all of us aware of their inherent vulnerabilities. This book should be a must read for any nature lover.
Hi Neha, welcome to The Hindu's Books Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. First up, Wild and Willful is a splendid book. To do a wildlife book blending empathy, aesthetics, and the right word, often lyrical, isn't easy. And you've ticked all those boxes. How did this book first germinate within you?
I think this book has been in me for a long time. And thank you for the kind words. I didn't want to write a doom and gloom book. I didn't want to write a book that was a bleeding heart book. Because I think there's a lot of doom and gloom associated with environment and a lot of grief and sorrow. I wanted to write a book that, can have both the wonder, the wonder, the beauty of nature, along with the worry that we have for it, but kind of like in equal proportions. And I think a lot of us look at nature as a form of solace, as a form of healing, as a beautiful thing, a pure thing. And a lot of us look at nature as something that is gone forever. So I just wanted to capture both those dimensions. And I also wanted to be sure that it should be really good writing. I didn't want to just do scientific, writing. So I wanted to combine a literary approach with nonfiction. Okay. And that's how it took a long time to find that tone, and kind of doing a little bit more show than tell. I'm not telling anybody what to do. I'm not prescribing how to do conservation, but just kind of trying to show that, this animal has value, trying to show that in a way that's literary, that I hope is well written. So that was really the approach that I had.
Okay. It's interesting. The secondary title for your book is Tales of 15 Iconic Indian Species. Now, how did you arrive upon this structure? I mean, wherein you do these wonderful portraits of the diverse species in India, highlight their current plight, focus on both their beauty and vulnerabilities, and also draw in the threads that bind us to them. And how did you go about this?
Yes. When we think about wild animals in India, I think the first thought that comes is the big ones, right? The tiger, the tiger in the forest, the elephant, elephants in temples even. And we actually share our lives with many kinds of animals in India, including the rhesus macaque monkey that comes to our cities, that opens our fridges, that slaps people. It slapped my mother. It's there in the book. And along with a whole host of birds and snakes. And I think I definitely wanted to capture the really critically endangered species that perhaps no one has heard of, because I think there are very little time left, like the great Indian bustard that lives in the Thar Desert, the white-bellied heron that lives in Arunachal Pradesh. But I also wanted to capture the common species, the ones that are much more common. I didn't want to have a hierarchy. I didn't want to say that, this is the tiger, which is a beautiful animal everyone knows, and I'm only going to talk to you about beautiful animals. I wanted to talk about animals that we actually encounter in our lives, and often animals that we hate. And that's why we have Magarmach, which, it's this big animal. I don't think anybody thinks the Magarmach is charismatic. It's there in a lot of places in India. It's there in the canals, it's there in the village ponds, it's there in reverse. And the Statue of Unity was made. One of the first things the Gujarat government did is it moved Magarmach from the Statue of Unity site to another place, another reservoir, because they thought that, you know, there would be conflict. And I wanted to ensure that we have a mix of species that are both awe-inspiring and people generally like, as well as the ones that we kind of don't like, the ones that we find ugly or not appealing, like, you know, the king cobra or even the cobra, you know. Every time we see a snake, we say, let's kill it because it's going to bite us. I wanted to kind of bust some of those myths. And basically, the book is what the animal needs. It's basically a portrait of each wild animal and what it needs.
In fact, to add to what you've just answered, I mean, generally, when you talk about wildlife in India, you get these stereotypes, you know, tigers and elephants. You do acknowledge these magnificent animals in your book. But at the same time, you do a hat tip to the others, ranging from leopards to Amur falcons, to the great Indian bustard, to the tiger butterflies. You flip between the jungle and our urban landscapes. It's a threat that I also see in your tweets too. You know, it's like, wake up citizens, gaze out of your windows, step into the gardens, you seem to say. I mean, it's an inference from my end. Could you speak about this approach?
Yes. You know, I really think nature is not something that's very far away from us, you know. We eat food that comes from the soil. We drink milk that comes from a cow's stomach. And, you know, we are actually animals, right? But we tend to forget that.
Yes.
And when we're living in cities, we don't really have an interface with nature. We just talk about nature if it's hot or cold that day, you know. The moment you step out in the cities, which you would have done being a sports person, you would know exactly what I'm saying. Nature is frightening. Nature is an agent in your life the moment you're outside the city. And, you know, if you're near the sea, then the sea can be scary. If you're in the mountains, then, you know, the sunlight is pitiless, absolutely. So I think we forget in cities that, you know, that there's something known as nature, but there's so much nature in cities as well, because they are corridors depending on which city you're in. So if you're in Chennai, the sea is playing a role in your life. And if you're in Delhi, Himalayas plays a role in your life. When it snows in the Shimla, it's really cold in Delhi. When there's a hot Loo in Thar Desert, it's really hot in Delhi. And what I'm trying to say is that nature is interwoven in our lives, even in the cities. And because we, most of us live in cities, I think it's important to start somewhere. And I grew up in a city myself, though my field work takes me very far from cities. But my first bird was a really common bird, you know. It was the red-whiskered bulbul in my garden. And for many of us, you know, who are consuming books, it's common birds and common animals in cities that is our first wild thing that we see. And cities need to have nature. We kind of need nature in cities more than nature needs us, because we need trees to buffer our noise pollution. We need parks to walk in. And I think COVID has also shown us that. The last chapter in the book, Love in the Times of COVID, you know, it was such a, 2020 was such an alienating year for all of us. We were all anxious, depressed. And I think the parks were so full of people. People were looking out of their balconies as well. People were doing balcony birding. People were rearing butterflies in their gardens. They were growing flowers and taking a walk to their nearby park as much as they could. Any city you go to in any part of the world, the parks are always full. And I think it's because we actually do love nature, but we kind of tend to forget that. I wanted to capture that. I wanted to, I just want whoever reads this book should pause and look outside his or her window. And just look at what's happening outside on the tree or on the, you know, the bird's nest. I just, that's what I want.
In fact, I love the preamble you set forth right in the beginning. I mean, on page 7, you write, a wild animal requires acceptance for what it is, not enslavement for what it what we want it to be. This is part of the most profound truth of the wild and the world at large, that we are a part of it, not its owners. And it's a tone that permeates his entire book. I mean, was it a very conscious thing you did? I mean, that you want to reiterate the fact that we are all part of nature, like what you said in the previous answer.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's also because I'm a woman, and because, you know, when you're a young woman in India, you grow up and everyone is telling you what to do all the time. And, you know, people want to own you and they want to have ownership of what you do. And they want to, there are these codes of conduct for women, and especially in wildlife conservation. Yes. And I'm sure sports women will tell you the same thing as well. You know, if a woman is doing something that's slightly different, you know, she's always told how to behave, what her boundaries are. And I obviously rebel against that. And I also feel great empathy for wild animals in the way that we try to mold them in the way that we want. So it's okay if the tigers in the forest in the tiger reserve, but it can't come out. It can't go anywhere else. You know, it's okay if, you know, the elephant is kind of, you know, very far away from us. It shouldn't come in our fields. And I think nature is much bigger than that. And right now, as we are speaking, there was a huge forest fire in Odisha. There was another forest fire in Bandhavgarh. You know, there's been this huge glacier break in Uttarakhand, which caused a flood. And of course, we're still not recovered from a man-made pandemic. And, you know, we keep having these disasters and we keep, you know, feeling bad and we keep forgetting about it. But actually, you know, in our country, we are constantly absorbing one disaster after the other, which is connected with nature. And still we think that, you know, we are better than nature and we can control it. And I think the way to work with this is to kind of work along with natural structures instead of trying to change them so much, you know, whether it's, you know, completely changing the shoreline on the coast, which should never be done, or whether it's mining the mountains, like, example is the Char Dham Highway, where, you know, the mountain has been broken to create this large highway. And there have been many avalanches because of that. And I just think that, you know, going back to what I was saying about codes of conduct, we do try to control everything, right? So society tries to control women or tries to control certain communities. And I think, you know, the same kind of approach is there for wildlife as well. You know, we want to control it, and it, as long as it's in the forest, it's fine, it's picturesque. The moment it leaves the forest, you know, it's a pest, it's unwanted. And we need to understand the drivers as to why they've come out of the forest, instead of just, you know, trying to control it in the way that we do. And I think you know, this year, 2021, when we are still kind of far away from each other because of COVID, I mean, if we don't realize that we don't own nature this year, I don't know when we are going to realize that.
The writing was fabulous. But I mentioned in the review too, be it the metaphors used, the similes employed. How did you arrive at your writing style? I mean, I saw a lot of Ruskin Bond, the kind in which he does his intimate portraits of nature as he observes things in the Himalayas. I mean, this was wildlife writing, according to me, aspiring to be literature. And it's a very high benchmark, and you scaled it. So how did you go about this?
That is such a compliment. Thank you so much. I have thanked Ruskin Bond in this book because he's such an inspiration
I read
for
that.
Me. Yeah. You know, I think Ruskin Bond has this talent of making the ordinary completely extraordinary. So I just had to work very hard at creating this tone. And I think, you know, for me, it was really important that the writing quality should be very good. I think we're living in an age where there's a lot of information. So you can Google Indian elephant and find everything. What does a book give? A book gives some perspective. And I think, you know, it should hopefully give good writing. So intimacy is definitely, you know, one of the ways that I approached intimacy with the subject, a kind of almost like a sensuousness, or almost like a, it's just like a kind of closeness you feel towards the subject, in which it feels like a character. So the animal is like a character in the story. You know, it's no longer a non-human, but something much closer. And I think it's also because I kind of tend to look at the natural world with a lot of enchantment. I find it to be very fascinating, because every time I observe nature, I find something that I didn't know before. And feeling that sense of awe, feeling like something is bigger than me, you know, I think that kind of reflects in the writing. I know that it makes me sound quite goofy or quite, somebody, you know, said to me the other day, a man on the internet said to me the other day that you shouldn't remain in a Disney world. So I, you know, to which I think my answer is a lot of the book is very serious. A lot, in fact, I think I'm quite serious about many things to do with environment, but I also don't want to lose that sense of enchantment that I do feel when I see, you know, even if it's a tiger butterfly in the garden, because I just feel it survives so much, you know, it's a survivor. And I wanted to capture that sense of wonder along with, of course, you know, the bad things, you know, the harsh reality. So it's kind of like dream and nightmare together.
Yeah, I know.
Wanted to capture both. And I do aspire to be a literary writer.
Okay.
I mean, it's an important thing for me. It's an important goal for me.
It's a lovely goal to have. You know, in fact, in the chapter headings too, you know, like Love in the Times of COVID-19, like obviously a hat tip to Gabriel Garcia Marquez, or even Don't Kiss a Cobra, I mean, which kind of strangely reminded me of Khushwant Singh's iconic short story, The Mark of Vishnu, which I'm sure we all have read in school. The literary trappings were all over, and it was such a pleasure because sometimes books like this tend to be like NCERT textbooks, you know, you get what I mean. This wasn't the case in this. I mean, it was free-flowing, it was fluid. You know, there was a lot of grace and style and dignity and beauty in the way you wrote it. I mean, so I need to compliment you on that.
Thank you.
The other thing is, the book highlights the beauty innate in wildlife and the lingering pathos too. I mean, I found the description of an elephant calf succumbing near the newly laid golf course. I mean, it was heartbreaking for me. This was emotional writing. And was there some kind of catharsis for you when you put pen to paper, when you were dealing with chapters like that or segments like that?
Honestly, a lot of portions of this book totally broke me when I was writing. And the elephant chapter, I was actually weeping when I wrote that because...
In fact, you mentioned in the book, you said you unraveled.
Yeah, absolutely. Because everything that we're doing is against the elephant. And we just expect the elephant to run from one place to the other, you know, and to be content with living a life in which it's just running all the time for its life. I don't have any catharsis because it's still happening, you know. Okay. And, you know, the incident of with the Kerala elephant, you know, in which she consumed this pineapple and it blew up and she died this painful death, you know. People were really surprised and saddened that a pregnant elephant has died like this. But the fact is most adult female elephants are either pregnant or lactating. And they have a very long pregnancy, which goes on for like 22 months. And once they have their calf, they are suckling their calf and the calf stays with the mother for a long time. And so basically, if you're an adult female elephant, then you're going to be pregnant or you're going to be lactating, which also means each, you know, female elephant that dies is basically the death of a, you know, a gene pool, which would have given birth or which would have taken care of its young. And they are such sentient animals. And I think everybody who has read this book has said that the elephant chapters made them cry. And I think it's also because they remind us so much of us. They are so deeply bonded. And they're so emotive, you know. You look at an elephant, it feels like a person, right? And unfortunately, you know, even though I feel this great love for nature, I can very well see what we are doing to it. And almost every National Board for Wildlife meeting clears these vast areas of forest, and we are basically cutting up elephant habitat every single day. And we have announcements that are really bold. Like we had the Prime Minister announcing that we now have 51 tiger reserves. But just very shortly after that, you know, UP and MP, Uttar Pradesh and Madhya Pradesh signed an agreement for Ken-Betwa River interlinking, which is basically interlinking Ken River with Betwa, which is going to drown 100 square kilometers of Panna Tiger Reserve, which is basically prime tiger habitat. And the tigers had gone extinct from Panna and they were repopulated. They were brought from another reserve and it was a long process of rewilding the entire place. And now it has all these tigers and 100 square kilometers are going to be drowned if the river interlinking takes place. And talking about elephants, you know, they're building, they want to expand the airport in Dehradun, which is part of an elephant reserve. Yeah. So Uttarakhand became the first state in India to denotify their elephant reserve, Shivalik Elephant Reserve. And like this, roads, railway lines are coming up every month. New proposals are coming up. And as the book shows, you know, an elephant can do many things, but it can't escape a railway line. It can't escape a trench. You know, it was not evolved for that. And I keep saying this to everybody. People find it hard to believe that a tiger would die under a train or an elephant would fall into a pit. But actually, in medieval times, that's how elephants were hunted. They would make pits and the elephant falls in, because it can't, it's got a big body. It can't, it's not nimble. It can't, come out once it falls in such a pit. And everywhere there's construction sites or open cast mining, they fall in and they all die together. This is what breaks my heart, because they try to save each other. And human beings say that I love you, I will die for you. Elephants actually do.
I know.
They actually do die for each other.
So,
I mean, writing a book like this, my goal was just, I wanted people to see what's happening. And there is unfortunately no catharsis, but I can just hope that, I can just hope more people can actually be aware. Maybe something changes somewhere in terms of policy making, because a lot of the destruction is state sponsored today. Unfortunately, that is the truth. And therefore, one hopes policy and planning can have a better view. I actually work in policy. My hope is policy should change.
So Neha, a man losing an arm to a crocodile and yet looking after them, for all the havoc that mankind wreaks on wildlife, there are also people like him, and that's heartening. And it's also refreshing to see you focus on these feel-good stories too, like the one about the Nagas shedding their hunter tag and turning conservators of the Amur falcons.
Yeah.
Was it a conscious effort not just to focus on the warts and all, but also on the positive news, however limited, in the zone of wildlife conservation?
Absolutely. I think there's always hope, right? I mean, I think generally it's bleak, but there's always, some hope somewhere in every field. You know, we can say the system is bad, but there'll be one individual who's amazing, right? And so, I mean, I want to showcase reality, and reality, of course, is ugly, but it's also... there are also people who are exceptions. And Babaji, Sitaram Das, the man who lost his forearm to the Magarmach, he has a certain love for his crocodiles. And I think what a love it is, the love between a man and a reptile. It's kind of like most implausible, right? Because, you can love a tiger. People have tigers in captivity and the tiger responds to you. It comes to you, it licks your face, But if you love a crocodile, like if you're taking care of this crocodile, it's not going to come rushing up to you. It's not going to demonstrate its affection in any way. They come when he calls them, but they don't do anything else. They just come, But I think it's a kind of acceptance of what they are. He understands what they are. He understands that they are a certain way. They have a certain stoicness. They just live near him, and they both live near each other, understanding their boundaries. And that's kind of love in its purest form in many ways, because it's just a total acceptance. And the Nagas and the Amur falcons, I think, I'm really interested in breaking stereotypes, and I'm really interested when, stereotypes do change, because it does happen, right? Like 50 years ago, 60 years ago, we were all hunting tigers, or at least it was a good thing that was seen as a good thing in India. Many families have, ivory or, tiger skins somewhere, as heirlooms. And now it's totally unacceptable to do that. So things do change. It takes time, but, change does happen. And the Nagas decided not to hunt Amur falcons. And, when you talk about Nagas to the rest of India, first of all, they are characterized as these savages who eat anything. And they are characterized in a way that makes them seem alien. And I think, we tend to other everybody who is not like us. The way we other animals, the way we make animals appear to be alien, we do the same to people that we don't know well. And because the Nagas have such a distinct culture that's so different, from other parts of India, we also have characterized Nagas as savage people. And it is true they have hunting cultures. It is true they eat dogs. But then that's a, the disgust and the morality, the moralizing that comes, that how can they eat dogs because we love dogs,
Yeah,
that's very unnecessary. We need to understand context. In any case, there was a conservation intervention in terms of the fact that, you know, there were conservation organizations working there, but ultimately the decision was taken by the Nagas themselves. And and they actually said that we want to change the story around us. You know, we don't want people to keep talking about us like we are these savages who are hunting all the time. We will show you that we can do things differently. We want to write our own story. And they decided to stop hunting Amur falcons. And I think this is something that really deserves applause, because it's that's what real conservation is. It's kind of done without the, you know, awards, without the documentation. Like even Sitaram Das, the guy whose hand got eaten, he just does it. You know, it's a way of life for him. There are no bells and whistles. There are no, you know, there are no embellishments. They've accepted it as part of their life, which is actually what true conservation is. It's not what I do, or it's not what some other people do in terms of, you know, an occupation. True conservation shouldn't be an occupation. It's actually a way of life. So I wanted to showcase that. And yes, I am also interested in, you know, challenging dominant paradigms of, you know, a hunter is a bad person. I don't think hunters are bad people. I think we need to understand context.
Neha, how do you think India can truly become a wildlife conscious country? In the sense that, I mean, are we in a zone where we speak about Project Tiger, you know, maybe pay a visit to Kanha and then say, okay, there are forest fires, the rangers will take care of it. Okay, there is wildlife, the NGOs will take care of it. I mean, is there a detached ambivalence among us towards wildlife, or do you see a change for the better?
I think there definitely is an ambivalence, and that's, you know, really the case of Avni Tigris really showcased that, where, you know, you had a lot of urban people. And I got a lot of flack for saying that a man-eating tigress should be put down. Because, you know, if she's man-eating, you cannot justify, you know, it her being there. And of course, you know, one is not blaming the animal, because the animal, there's certain drivers, reasons why it became like that. But, you know, urban conservationists who say, who are basically saying the life of a poor man is not worth the same as the life of a, you know, person living in the city, that, you know, it, all of this happens in villages where, you know, tigers eat people. So this is clearly a kind of classism, which I'm completely against. And there's a lot of this happening now, because, you know, there are people in cities who want to do something, but, you know, I must urge them to understand, you know, how somebody can is living a very deprived life if there's a dangerous animal. And also, you know, taking a blessing from an elephant in a temple while saying, you know, while not seeing, you know, how did the elephant get there? Because it's a really long and cruel process in the way the elephant is broken. I think we definitely have a bipolar attitude, and, you know, we feed the monkeys and we throw stones at them, you know, you're feeding it in the temple, you're stoning it outside the temple. I think the point is that it is not somebody else's business. It's kind of each one of us has to try to engage as much as possible. And, you know, everybody can't do everything. So I will actually start with the state. You know, my hope is the state needs to put its money where the mouth is, because we only talk about wildlife in platitudes. So we'll say sustainable development, and India should grow sustainably. But, you know, when it comes to the big projects, those are the ones that really impact wildlife. You know, the really big, like river interlinking, or the really big ports that come up, or the really big coal mines that come up. These are the ones that we need to reimagine, because there's no looking away from the fact today that the state is the biggest threat to wildlife. And I, you know, through the policy, you know, insights that are there in this book, I want people to understand that decision making needs to take into account all the wildlife, because we are just pretending the wildlife is not there, and then we get really surprised if, you know, it comes up. So you're making this golf course in Kaziranga. You know, I have nothing against golf. Why would I, you know, have anything against a golf course? But I just feel it shouldn't be near Kaziranga. It shouldn't be in Kaziranga's no development zone, because there's a reason that place has been protected. And I think the logic needs to come in terms of thinking about what are the animals in the area and thinking how the animal uses the landscape. So, you know, if you're making a big road, you need to consider how the animal will cross the road. And what we do right now is that we take a road or we take a bridge or whatever project we are making and we just put it there without looking at the area around it. And then when it gets flooded or then when animals come, we get very surprised. So because we still have so much wildlife, I think it's really important that ecological concerns have to be mainstream. There's no other way. And I think, you know, I think our life would just be poorer also if we didn't have this kind of wildlife and nature in our lives.
So thanks for this wonderful conversation, Neha. And for our listeners, I mean, do read Wild and Willful. It will surely make you look at wildlife in a fresh perspective. Thank you so much, Neha. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to The Hindu on Books. You can now find The Hindu's podcasts such as In Focus and Parlay on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher and other major platforms. Write to us with comments and feedback at socmed4@thehindu.co.in.